ramen with handmade noodles, unique slow simmer dashi, and more. Dinner was provided by Lardo with two Portland locations at 1212 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard and 1205 Southwest Washington Street, as well as a Las Vegas location at 3708 South Las Vegas Boulevard. Lardo serves deli-style sandwiches as well as craft beers and cocktails every day from 11 a.m. until 10 p.m. or later. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm/give right now. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival from Friday, April 19th through Sunday, April 21st at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Portland Eco Film Festival celebrates Earth Day 2019 with a weekend of films including a special 420 screening of Dreams, a documentary about Brazilian modernist landscape designer Roberto Burle Marx and the world's first giraffeologist who fought for women's rights in scientific fields, and more. Again, that's Portland Eco Film Festival from Friday, April 19th through Sunday, April 21st at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Jordan Cove is a liquid natural gas or LNG project that requires quite a bit of force in order to stop it. There are people all over Oregon who are ready to throw down the gauntlet and let the people who support it know that this is unacceptable. If we want to get serious about fighting climate change, well then that's going to mean ordinary people coming together and not just making their voices heard, but committing themselves to serious campaigns that are willing and ready to shut down business as usual. And I say business as usual on purpose, because the people who are going to be at the front of this fight are not going to care about profits. And they believe it when they say that we need to put people before profits. And oftentimes people say that, but they don't mean it. So of course I'm talking about the socialists, the people who can give 2 cents if people are able to continue to rake in their money like they do. So I'm lucky enough to be in the studio with someone who is helping to launch the fight against Jordan Cove. You may know him from his run for city council years ago that helped to put the $15 minimum wage in this town on the map, with 15 now Oregon, and continues to be a leader in the community, an educator, and an activist. And of course, I'm talking about Nicholas Caleb. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you.
So I want you to come on. First of all, we have a person who gave us a grant for today's show, which is very nice. $250 is a match available. This is coming from Environmental Paper and Print. So we appreciate that. And if one of my listeners calls in up to $250, know that that will be matched. And that's coming from Environmental Paper and Print. But Nick, I want you to help to educate the listening audience so that if there's something missing around this fight against Jordan Cove that's not already being covered, that widely people don't know, I just want you to fill in some blanks. So if we can start by talking about why fight against Jordan Cove, why would we?
Sure. And I'll start. It's an old fight and it's a new fight all at the same time. And so the Jordan Cove project is now owned by a company called Pembina. And Portland listeners will probably remember the name Pembina because they were the Canadian company that was supporting a propane export terminal at the Port of Portland in 2015. And it sparked a big resistance in Portland that ended up defeating that project and leading to a whole bunch of other interesting things happening here. So they bought the project a little over a year ago and kind of resuscitated it after it had been defeated by, strangely enough, the federal government shot down the project last time. And so it was still the Obama administration, but the project, which is a 300-mile long pipeline from Malin, Oregon, which is just outside of Klamath Falls, to the coast at Coos Bay, crossing something like 300 waterways, and carrying fracked gas for export. It's compressed in Coos Bay and then put on giant tankers and taken overseas for export. So that project was denied by the agency called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And they denied the project essentially because they said it wasn't in the public interest because they didn't get enough landowners to sign voluntarily their land away for easements. And so the government would have had to do a bunch of eminent domain on behalf of a Canadian corporation, and they were uneasy about that. And so they ended up denying the project as being against the public interest. And so activists who had been fighting already at that point, like 10 years against a project that was originally for import and then became an export project, and it went through several iterations, several different owners, were ecstatic when they defeated that project. And it's very, very rare for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to deny anything. I think it was one of the first, if not the first, gas export project that the feds have ever denied like that. Mm. So that was amazing. And but then as soon as the Trump administration came into office, Jordan Cove investors put an application and basically tried to push the same project again. And so that was that happened about a year and a half ago. And now, so we're back into the fight. And some other things that are interesting and new about the project this time through, I think, is it was more of a Southern Oregon regional fight before, I think. And the organizing from groups like Rogue Climate down in Southern Oregon and others has been great.
Shout out Rogue Climate.
Yeah, Rogue Climate, excellent organization, some terrific organizers. And they've really raised the profile of this project in a way that it's become kind of like Pacific Northwest regional, and there's even a lot of national interest in the project because it would be the biggest gas export facility on the West Coast and Oregon's largest climate project ever. Okay. So big deal. So where we're at right now is we've had a couple of permit timelines, permit comment opportunities come and go. First, there was what's called a 401 Clean Water Act permit opportunity for comment. And basically what that means...
Who was holding the comments?
The state. So the Department of Environmental Quality was the first.
The Department of Environmental Quality. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a federal law, but they get to administer it the state. And I'll start with the technical stuff and then we'll get into the politics a little bit later. But so starting with the technical stuff, state gets to administer water quality permits. And if they deny the permits, then theoretically this project couldn't move forward. So there's a little bit of state control in this project. So clean water permit came and something like 45,000 Oregonians submitted Clean Water Act comments, which is unheard of, like probably a record.
How were they mobilized?
Rogue Climate and other Southern Oregon groups like Rogue River Keeper and the Klamath Tribes, and with support from some Eugene and Portland-based groups, were able to mobilize that many people throughout the region in order to submit comments to that project. So huge, huge success. And it really put it back on the map and showed legislators who have been remiss to even acknowledge it exists.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you to all those organizers. 45,000 is nothing to sneeze at. So thank you.
Yeah, huge record for the state, for the Department of Environmental Quality. And then an agency called the Department of State Lands had to hold a permit process for what's called a removal fill permit. So whenever the pipeline would have to cross a stream, they'd have to remove soil and bury the pipeline and all the rest and then fill it back in. And so the Department of State Lands had to hold a permitting period for that. And I think like 50-something thousand people commented on that one. So we raised the stakes and even added more folks. And
when did this happen? What's the timeline here?
So the clean water permit stuff was last summer.
Okay.
And then the Department of State Lands permit was earlier. I guess it started in the winter and ended up in like January or something, I think.
Okay.
And so it wasn't that long ago, but there were so many comments that got sent in that the Department of State Lands actually had to like extend their decision timeline because they have to actually read through them and everything. And so both
pesky,
of those,
pesky
yeah,
details.
I know, it's terrible. So both of those permits, the state permits, are going to be decided probably in September. And so that's on the state side. And then on the kind of federal side here, just a few weeks ago, what's called a draft environmental impact statement was released by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and we're currently writing comments and others are writing comments on that. And so those comments are due by July 5th, I think. So there's kind of parallel state and federal permitting processes going on. A permit denial at the state or a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission denial would defeat the project again. We think it's probably unlikely that the feds are going to deny the project this time because Trump administration pressure.
Sure.
And, you know, the industry has putting tons of pressure because, you know, they want to get as many fossil fuels out as possible as fast as they can before their industry gets clamped down on. Mm-hmm. So kind of the technical side. And then on the political side, as advocates and as tribal communities and others who have leaned into the process and are trying to organize, we're not only having to fight against the corporations and the federal government, but we're having to fight against our own governor and our Democratic legislature, which at least now probably there's like 6 or 7 Democrats who have acknowledged the project exists and have signaled opposition, but the governor still is occupying a place of neutrality. And this is in spite of years and years of rhetoric of being a climate champion and wanting to do all this stuff and make sure that we're, you know, going to be in line with the Paris Accords and all this like grandstanding, but just kind of has this spot carved out where she just like will not acknowledge that this project exists.
Do you know why?
Well,
or do you think you, what are your thoughts?
We're pretty sure that it has to do with the building trades, which are a big Democratic constituency and their union that likes to build fossil fuel infrastructure, among other things. I mean, they'll pretty much build anything, but they really want the temporary jobs from this, and so they're exerting a lot of pressure. And we think the second reason is that the governor's kind of policy baby is the cap and trade program, and the way, even though the Democrats have a supermajority, some of the more like conservative members of the party hold power in key committees. So there's a senator called Arnie Roblin from Coos Bay, who's like a Koch brothers Democrat, and he is really supportive of the project and potentially could, you know, in committee mess with the cap and trade bill. So we think that there's some dynamics going on there too, where he's basically kind of like holding his vote for silence of legislators and the governor on stuff. So that's probably the two dynamics. And then there's some natural gas money like flooding into our system as well. And so with those kind of, that dynamic has kind of kept the governor on the sideline in a strange way.
So thank you for laying that out, first of all. And again, I just want to let people know that, like, so what I heard that was most important was the numbers 45,000 and 55,000. So last summer, 45,000 people in Oregon lodged comments in opposition.
Yep.
Then in the winter, this last winter, 55,000. Right.
Yep.
So I want to, first of all, say thank you if you are one of those 55,000 people. Thank you for doing that. And then also just to highlight that those people were able to slow down this process and were able to get some attention and get on the record as being the most comments ever submitted.
Yeah.
In Oregon? That's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And it costs Jordan Cove's investors money, too. When they were hoping for a really accelerated timeline and to be having, you know, shovels in the ground by the end of this year or next summer. And there's no way that they're going to meet those deadlines anymore. And so fossil fuel investors who are like kind of waiting and seeing on these projects are, you know, the longer that you can delay projects like this, it's not as satisfying as getting a clear denial. It's always the best, but probably the odds are in our favor in the long term in terms of projects like this. So the longer that we can hold them from getting their shovels in the ground and starting construction on projects like this, the better. So, I mean, I would rather spend my time on other stuff, to be honest, but the more that we can hold them at bay and kind of like overload the system, I guess, a little bit. The system's not really designed for us, to be honest, but in the Pacific Northwest, especially over the last 5 or 6 years with these larger fossil fuel projects, we've really figured out how to mobilize people in a way that kind of just like pours so much political energy into these like existing areas that they're not really democratic, but we're like forcing them to become democratic. Like the spotlight.
You're shining a light.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. And so people pay attention. It's a lot harder to just sneak stuff through. And so in the case of Jordan Cove, that's been done extremely successfully. And then, you know, while we've kind of got these sort of stalemate periods and we have to wait, then we organize in other ways and we mm-hmm. put pressure on the governor. So there's folks from Eugene and Southern Oregon that have been interrupting state land board meetings, you know, like every month for the last 6 months.
And thank you.
Putting pressure on the governor and calling her out for, you know, not, you know, talking the climate champion route and not mm-hmm. putting up. And yeah, so it's ongoing, really amazing organizing. I was down in Southern Oregon for a year working in Klamath on this and recently just moved back up to Portland. But
welcome
very,
back.
Very inspiring to be a part of that stuff.
So what's happening now on KBOO is we're in our spring membership drive. We are encouraging people to join KBOO, to become a member. People will notice that they do not get commercials from LNG corporations, from fossil fuel giants. No, you will not get that. But we do take pledges, and we're calling on people to join and to pledge now. Again, thank you to Environmental Paper and Print for offering up a $250 match. So what that means is if one of our listeners calls in and donates up to $250, that $250 is going to be matched. And again, that's from Environmental Paper and Print. So they are right on the mark for what we're talking about today. So thank you all very, very much. More about sort of where we're at now. So thank you for laying out the background of sort of where the Jordan Cove project comes from, the impetus behind it, who's laid the groundwork for where we are now. But let's talk about where we are now. So what is the ask to everyone who's listening?
If you wanted to get involved right now, I think the easiest first step would be to make contact with groups like Rogue Climate, and there's a group on Facebook called No LNG Exports, and Rogue River Keeper is another organization. All of them have online presences, and they're really easy to get in touch with. And so I'd say step one, you know, send a note and ask how you can get involved. And generally, at the very least, you can get on an email list, which is a good first step. And then they send out action updates. So getting into a network is important. In Portland, if you're, you know, maybe it makes more sense for you to get organized in a Portland-specific manner. There are some, there's a group called Stop Fracked Gas, PDX, which has biweekly meetings to support organizing in Southern Oregon, but also opposing fracked gas projects in Tacoma and elsewhere in the Pacific Northwest. So those are groups you can get involved with as well. And you know, resources are always limited. So if you've got resources to contribute to stuff like that, and KBOO, by the way, always good.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I feel like the other ask is to start getting kind of prepared for what happens if permits are granted and the project goes and shovels get in the ground and start building it, because then we're in the position where we know that, you know, we've got something like 11 years to really, really reduce carbon emissions, something 45% over the next 10, 11 years, or
it's very ambitious.
it is very ambitious, so it's going to require a lot of tinkering, to say it lightly, in our system. And the things that we know that we cannot do that are non-negotiable all the way is build new fossil fuel infrastructure. We can't export, extract, burn any more than we already do. So like putting a cap where we're at and right. turning things back and then building out of it is really important. So when projects like this, if projects like this are granted permits, then it probably is going to become an issue of direct action for lots of different communities and trying to resist.
So just so that people know, what is the other side saying? How do they justify this?
Money will bring jobs and investment to your communities.
Oh, dear.
And there are counties, some counties in Southern Oregon supportive of this. So Klamath County, for example, is supportive of the project because they get something like $5 million of tax revenue. The Jackson County is opposed. They don't want it, which is the county that Medford's in. Coos County, where Coos Bay is and the Jordan Cove facility is there, they support it because similar, there'd be a facility in operation and would employ jobs. And Jordan Cove is sponsoring their own police department, which is kind of weird. They like created a Jordan Cove specialized police department.
Sure.
So they're creating
jobs. Standing Rock
had
their own force, yeah.
Yeah, and that happens on the East
Coast.
I hope
it doesn't come to that.
Yeah, so from the rural community standpoint, at least from the more conservative folks in charge there, those are jobs and all jobs pretty much are good. And so even though the projects like this come with risk of fires and explosions and they cross drinking water areas and they can interrupt tourism economy and all sorts of stuff. If you're on the coast, there's...
Yeah, but can't they invest in insurance for that so that they get a payout if that happens?
Insurance companies aren't going to cover the types of risks that are involved in projects like this, at least fully. I mean, to my knowledge, nobody's done...
So really, it's like just a gamble. Just... We hope it doesn't.
I mean, extraction economy in a lot of ways is that gamble. Like all of the easily accessible coal, oil, and gas is long gone. Like, you know, if folks have seen movies like There Will Be Blood or just know a little bit about kind of the oil history, there used to be a time when you had these really easily accessible oil wells where you say, you know, stick a straw on the ground and oil will come flooding out. Like that, those days have long passed. And so we're in already an era of high risk energy extraction. And so a project like the tar sands or the Bakken oil shale or a lot of the fracking projects that you hear about, they come with extraordinary ecological impacts for the communities that are on the front lines there. And so people are
Can you say how?
Sure. Mm-hmm. So fracking is known, some of the materials that they use in their fracking lubricants can...
And fracking means hydraulic fracturing.
Hydraulic fracturing,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it's a method. Basically, you drill and you put pressure into subterranean areas and it cracks, fractures shale, and then you pull out the gas molecules basically and extract those and then capture them on the front side. And so... the lubricants for the drills and the extraction equipment can leak into the groundwater and make people sick. And so,
and do.
Yeah. And so there's like a really well documented, I mean, there are films from, I think, the Gasland or something like that,
yes.
Where it's one of the first films where they showed, you know, like community, like lighting their
faucet water.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Lighting on fire. And so there's that kind of impact. And then of course, if you drink that, then there's illnesses that come along with that. And then there's like the risks along transportation. So there's pipeline explosions and terminal explosions. Mm. And if you're putting a fossil fuel on rail, there's train derailments and explosions. And sometimes
the images of trains exploding with oil. Oh my God! Like it looks like something from like a Hollywood movie, like a big budget film, but this is real. This is dystopian, having like watching this on normal 6 o'clock news.
Yeah. And when first responders who have interacted with that stuff tell stories later on and they're talking about the rail cars exploding and just like the sounds that they're hearing, you know, they're just like in disbelief that can even be reality, and nobody's prepared to handle those types of accidents.
Right. How could you?
the fracking equipment. Right. There's like air quality concerns. They have these what are called compressor stations where they pressurize the gas before they ship it, and all sorts of emissions that are polluting communities come out of those.
Yes.
There are human rights epidemics wherever there's extraction. So you have these what they call like man camps that are set up with like, you know, because it's kind of like gold rush mentality. There's a rush to just like get all this stuff out of the ground. And so, you know, people that can do trucks or operate a rig, generally, you know, like younger men who can leave their families or maybe they don't have families and go like make a ton of money in a short amount of time. So there's like a lot of sex trafficking and in these
and
areas.
Missing indigenous women.
Right. So that's, and especially that, because a lot of these projects are taking place in indigenous lands. I mean, everything in this country is on indigenous land, but near reservations and, mm-hmm. and areas. So yeah, then you have sex trafficking epidemics and missing and murdered indigenous women. And so there's just a lot of, it's basically just evil economy wherever it mm-hmm. goes. And so you have all sorts of impacts, whether they're environmental or human rights. There's risks. Oklahoma is, you know, like they have fracked so much in Oklahoma that they're experiencing all these earthquakes all the time because they've just disrupted everything so much. And for a while, people were like, no, it can't be due to the fracking. And mm-hmm. now it's becoming more accepted that these really unusual and intensifying seismic events are because they've destabilized their just like subterranean environment so much. So, I mean, we're really lucky in Oregon right now that we don't live in fossil fuel regions, like the extractive regions. But mm-hmm. As this economy expands and is kind of hopefully on its last light legs here, mm-hmm. they're trying to get as much out as possible, even if it's not economically viable. Investors are still throwing money in this mm-hmm. and just trying to squeeze out every job, and it becomes more and more and more dangerous. And so the what you call like the sacrifice zones are just increasing and moving to other places. And so mm-hmm. that's kind of what's happening in Southern Oregon. The pipeline will contain all sorts of risks, and there's the climate aspects, and there's mm-hmm. the tidal, you know, waves from seismic events and all the rest. But really, there's also an element of, yeah, let's protect our places. But there should also be an element of solidarity here, because where there's a fossil fuel project, there's a life cycle. There's a place where it originates and there's a place where it ends. And pretty much throughout the entire life cycle, somebody's suffering or being exploited or harmed.
So if you can look through some of your notes, if it's not in the front of your mind, I want to know about some of the dates of interest that are coming up related to the fight against Jordan Cove.
KBOO so would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. So breakfast was provided by Bridges Cafe and Catering,
right now,
located at 2716 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Bridges is a restaurant and catering company that's open daily. More information available at bridgescafeandcatering.net. Lunch was provided by Boki Bowl, with two locations at 1028 Southeast Water Avenue and 1200 Northwest 18th at Northrop. Boki Bowl serves ramen with handmade noodles, unique slow simmer dashi, and more. Dinner was provided by Lardo, with two Portland locations at 1212 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard and 1205 Southwest Washington Street, as well as a Las Vegas location at 3708 South Las Vegas Boulevard. Lardo serves deli style sandwiches as well as craft beers and cocktails every day from 11 a.m.
Okay, I will. I can do the promo. She'll cue me in when it's my time.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Okay. All right. So thank you very much. I want to thank all of the people who are supporting KBOO. So that was a message from one of our sponsors while we're here. And again, just so that no one thinks that we are not living by our word here, we absolutely will not accept any money from oil and gas giants, any companies that are doing that work. So Nick, I was hoping that you can let people know about some dates of interest that are coming up, so that people who don't have the money to donate, right, they are very worthy, we need you, may not have the time to join the campaign, but do have the want to show up when it matters, to participate in collective action. So dates coming up for collective action, and what are they?
So the biggest, we're in sort of like a quiet period right now because a lot of the permit deadlines have passed, but the next big one is July 5th. We have the draft environmental impact statement comment deadline. So right now you can actually submit a comment on the draft environmental impact statement. For most people, it's, you know, these are like huge documents that are really hard to dig through by yourself. And so the coalition that works on Jordan Cove resistance is actually hosting a series of comment writing workshops throughout the state. And
Go to one.
And so throughout May, there are several in Southern Oregon. I probably won't announce all the dates just because, you know, I don't know how many listeners are actually in Southern Oregon, but if you go to Rogue Climate...
I'm about to get syndicated, Nicholas Caleb. Don't call me out.
Okay. So Rogue Climate's webpage, Facebook page, I just checked, has their sort of four, I think they've got one in Coos Bay and Shady Cove, Medford, Klamath, maybe Roseburg. So there's at least five that will be going on in May. And then I don't think we've announced one in Portland yet, but I'm guessing that either late May or June, we're going to have a couple of comment writing workshops in Portland. And so the places to get connected to for that would be Stop Fracked Gas PDX, which has a Facebook group, or Power Past Fracked Gas Coalition. It also has a Facebook group.
Can you repeat that just for people who may be writing it down like I am?
Sure. Stop Fracked Gas PDX and Power Past Fracked Gas. And both of those groups have Facebook and Twitter accounts and will be announcing the comment writing workshops on there. Usually what we do is we'll like put up a Facebook event page or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We did those for the comment writing workshops for the state permits, and so we'll do that with the draft environmental impact statement as well. And those are nice because you can come sit with a bunch of other people, get like a top to bottom education on the project, and then kind of walk through the major issues that mm-hmm. have been identified in the draft environmental impact statement, and then they'll help you to tailor your comments to your experience. Okay. So some people, you know, will really care about like endangered species, and mm-hmm. so they can write about endangered species. Some people really care about the air quality impacts, and other people will care about the seismic issues and all the rest. And it's for those types of comments, like both like making a good argument that's based on the environment impact statement, but also personalizing it to you is always really important. So
okay.
we can help you do that stuff.
So let's say that you get all of the turnout that you want for the workshops and people turn in their comments, and we break another record, right? This time it's 65,000 comments. What is your projection for what will happen after that?
We'll put out a lot of press and talk about how, you know, this is a big issue for the public, mm-hmm. and largely because, you know, we're organizing so well, the vast majority of comments that are sent in for these projects are in opposition.
Sure.
So it puts even more pressure on the governor and the state bureaucracies and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission as well. So it's like I was saying before, like it's not the end all be all. I mean, I don't right now, these are the opportunities that exist for us, right? Because the state has a process,
sure. yeah.
and so we involve ourselves.
No, this is due diligence. I'm very happy that this is being done.
Yeah, and so we involve ourselves there, and we make sure that we do everything we can along every step of the way,
right.
always making a stronger ask each time through to the governor.
Sure.
So ultimately, even though this is a federal process, our main coalition target is Governor Brown. And
sure.
we want the pressure to be on her
Sister
consistently.
Kate, come on.
Yeah, and she wants to pass it off to other people. Like, she wants to pass the Department of State Lands decision off to an administrator. You know, she wants to kind of play this neutral role that's, like, politically safe.
It's not tenable.
And we have to force her into a position of opposing the pipeline. So, and the big one, so that's in July, and that's all good. But like I said before, our chances
are... What is
are
in July? Can you say that again?
The comment deadline.
Oh, great. Oh, that's the deadline.
Yeah,
okay.
In July 5th.
July 5th deadline. Thank
and
you.
Then what we're really, really, really waiting on are the September deadlines. Those are going to be the sort of go time signals. So if the state denies either the water permit or if they deny the state lands permit, then, you know, probably the industry will sue the state and all the rest, say you're not allowed to do that. But we'll be in really, really, really good position at that point. The state will have exercised its power to protect Oregon's lands, waters, and people. And that's good. And then we can come to the defense of a state decision.
Okay.
On the flip side of that, if the state grants those permits, we're going to be in a really rough position, because mm-hmm. then suddenly not only are we going to be fighting Trump's Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, we're going to have to be fighting our own state bureaucracies and mm-hmm. all the rest, and probably that'll be time for people to think about how we're going to organize resistance in Southern
Oregon. This really should be, ideally, if Sister Kate, Governor Kate Brown, comes through and launches a fight, then it'll look like the state of Oregon versus the federal government?
Basically, yeah.
Wow.
The state versus the feds and the fossil fuel industry, basically.
What a great opportunity for her to show her anti-Trump chops.
Yeah. And it's, so there's...
A great opportunity.
There's a huge opportunity. And it's in line with what she's been talking about for years around climate change. You know, when Trump said that he was going to do offshore drilling.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Brown was quick to say, not in our waters, you won't, you know, and came out and said, I'll do anything I possibly can to stop this. And that was kind of like a clear federal issue where the state doesn't have a lot of power. And so it was really easy for her to be like, this is bad, you know, because she didn't have any political capital to lose. She didn't have to make a choice. On this issue, it's not so clear. It's like a federal project in a lot of ways, but the state does have some authority and we could interrupt it. So she has to make a tough choice. And so far, she's been unwilling to step out there.
And you think it is because of the pressure of the building trades?
Yeah, especially during the election cycle. That's okay. When it was really big. And we, you know, the reason I know that is partially just because of materialist analysis of like mapping all this kind of stuff.
Oh, we're going to get to your materialist analysis.
Uh-huh. But also, you know, Senator Merkley ended up coming out in opposition to this project a couple years ago, and he was the first elected official that really took made the right move on this, where he
the correct move,
right? Yeah, exactly the correct move, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the same kind of pressure that we were putting on Governor Brown, we were putting on him, and he made the choice that his climate rhetoric and the support of the trades on this specific issue were not, you couldn't. They were too contradictory, and he had to choose, and he picked climate, which was great.
Okay.
And most other folks have been kind of hanging in the middle, so it's been hard to move people. And
that's sustainable.
Building trades are a powerful lobby, and they donate a lot in campaigns. And you know, the Democrats don't want to be seen to oppose working people either. So it's an understandable pressure. And you know, inside of the climate movement, we've been trying for years to make, you know, the connections to try to like pull the trades out of wanting to support the pipeline and the pipeline type.
Yeah,
project,
I know some great environmentalists that are in the trades.
Totally, and it's leadership is still kind of stuck in that mindset, and so there's still.
But it's the leadership, the bureaucracy that
seems so. It seems so, and I think they'll like the building trades. Columbia Building Trades came out and supported the Portland Clean Energy Fund, for example. So they're not
shout out PSEF.
Yeah, so yeah. They're not phobic to climate per se. Like they'll come and caucus when there's work that the trades can get, like that. Yeah, of course they'll support anything where there's like jobs coming in, but they're still in kind of a we'll take anything type posture. And it from the inside of the labor organizations, it makes sense because their members don't really have like permanent jobs, right? Right. So
they get contracts.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they're always kind of in what like this temporary zone. And so when people are kind of like, oh, these are temporary jobs, in a dismissive sense, the trades get really defensive, and they're like, well, that's our careers. Like we string together temporary jobs. So it's understandable.
Not all jobs are temporary under capitalism.
Right,
but
right,
go
right.
On.
But from there, that's their perspective, right? And so they, for now, they're still in a position of like, well, our members, we want them to build whatever comes along. And so we'll support solar plants and seismic upgrades and energy efficiency retrofits.
So that's the other side. That's what needs to be built.
Right. But we'll also support pipelines and export terminals and all the rest. So
this is why I want you to also talk a little bit about, if people follow you on social media, as I do, and you all should, you were talking about like how to make the Green New Deal real. And I want you to explain that to my listeners, who don't have the pleasure of following you on Twitter. So what does that mean? So the Green New Deal, of course, a series of legislation that are geared toward cleaning the climate, putting people to work in a sustainable way, building back the gains that have been torn away from communities as a result of neoliberal onslaughts, and on and on. Similar to the original New Deal, and but this time more geared toward saving us from environmental degradation. If you could talk a little bit more about it and then say how you think it could be made real, please do.
Sure. So it was really exciting in the fall when, I mean, a lot of this stuff in the mainstream politics and sort of where the spectacle is, it's kind of luck, you know, like somebody makes a move at some point and it just kind of catches hold. And we got one of those sort of really lucky, positive, transformative media moments when a bunch of young people started occupying congressional offices over climate.
The Sunshine Movement.
Yeah, Sunrise. Yes. And,
Sunrise, excuse me.
Yeah, and Ocasio-Cortez went with and did the sit-in, and it immediately just like...
Oye, Boricua.
The framework of the Green New Deal just like took off, right? And people were so inspired. And for a little bit, it didn't really have any kind of... And it's still, to a lot of ways, I think that we don't necessarily have to put boundaries on it right now. Like, this is a space of imagination for us right now where we should think as broadly and as aggressively as possible while we can. So the Democrats, Ocasio-Cortez and others, put up a resolution, and it has a lot of environmental related stuff of getting, it doesn't actually talk about getting off of fossil fuels, unfortunately. It talks about carbon neutrality, which, you know, then there's been big arguments about that, but you know, carbon neutral in line with climate science and big jobs programs, a jobs guarantee. They even tucked stuff like single-payer healthcare in there. And so it's the way that it was imagined by those folks is that a big group of social programs that would rebuild a safety net, put people back to work, building the infrastructure that's going to transition us away from the extraction economy into something that's more human-centered and care-centered. And, you know, we can start imagining a world where people don't have to grind themselves into dust working in the machine, you know, and that we can actually have employment, be taken care of, and then have a future that's not going to be polluted and terrible, basically.
Okay. Yeah. And then moving into how we might be able to make that real. So the concrete steps to move forward.
Yeah. So I call me cynical.
Cynical.
But I don't think that the congressional route is bound to work just because there's a good idea and we're kind of motivated about it. Even with a big Democratic wave, I mean, we see sort of the same thing I'm complaining about earlier. We see a supermajority in Oregon.
And dear.
I'm sure that you've talked about many things on the show where we have plenty to complain about.
It's a lesson for everyone. Oh my goodness, we have a supermajority in Oregon Congress, and look at where we're at. Look at these weak bills that aren't going anywhere. For people who think that the blue wave is the way forward, please study Oregon, because this is what's waiting for you at the national level. It's not a guarantee. I cut you off.
In our lifetimes, cynical. In our recent lifetimes, even for the younger of us, like, we witnessed it with Obama, you know, coming into office with a huge wave of Democrats and all the rest, like huge, huge historic majorities and supermajorities and all the rest. And we watched, you know, he wasn't a radical, but still, like, you know, members of his own party, like Joe Lieberman, you know, basically like sat there, and who knows what the actual inside game was, but, you know, conservative Democrats just kind of like took a position, took a couple of votes away that they couldn't overcome the filibuster, and like all that momentum just kind of died away. And so, you know, I just, having lived through that, and I was in law school when that stuff was going on, and paid close attention and watched how that worked, and was like, okay, like there's something going on here. So elections aren't on their own going to get it done for us. It's interesting and good that the spectacle associated with Ocasio-Cortez and the kids at Sunrise who did this, that they put this into the public consciousness, is great. Like, no shade there. It's great. And the fact that they're negotiating, putting things into resolution, it's pretty good.
And like, interrupting Pelosi.
Exactly.
That was a beautiful moment.
So there's a tension that's good for movements that's happening right now. Yes. And the left is building more power in the electoral realm.
Extinction and so, Resistance?
Extinction Rebellion.
Rebellion in London and, yeah. and then today or yesterday in New York City. And you know, maybe Portland. We'll see what happens. You know, all my anarchist friends, I hope you're paying attention.
Yeah, let's put a note for that because I have an announcement for that. So all that's great. And we're in this position now of like really what I think is that we should just start rethinking everything. Like we're given an opportunity. The popularity of the Green New Deal is, you know, exactly this type of thinking is exactly what we need to push back on the opposite side of the aisle, the fascists who are imagining what their utopia is, which is they're scared of climate change too, but their, you know, goals are let's build borders, let's segregate, let's reinstitute patriarchy, let's reinstitute white supremacy to even a more strict degree, let's become more violent and all the rest. And let's
to the exclusion. Our yeah. So thank you for saying that. They know. The ones who are denying it now or accept it to be true, but poo-poo any recommendations to improve things, they are ready to expand the prison industrial complex. Look no further than the concentration camps at the border. Those are for you. You know. So after all is said and done, you think they're going to let those facilities be vacant? I don't think so. Therefore, everybody who dares to rise up, and I hope that people get smart and start rising up before it's too late and people do start going there. And more than that, fighting the existence of them now. The prison industrial complex and the fight against ecological devastation, I think, need to always be right there.
And that's right wing climate policy, right? They don't talk about it like that, but as, you know, climate related disasters and resource wars and the other negative effects on human life from colonization take place, people try to escape and they try to run and, you know, they run away from places where they're being threatened and
sure.
their families are being murdered horrifically and all the rest. And so they run in Central America, they run north, and in Mexico, they run north. And then they're met by militias, you know, who are basically like capturing people and putting them in concentration camps and who knows what other kind of awful shit that we don't even know about.
And not just capture. You know, Nick, thank you. You know, you that is true. And many of those people, they're not trying to cross the border illegally. They are giving themselves over, right? And want to get asylum. And then they get put into the concentration camps, right? So it's not just like all of these rogue people that are trying to cross, quote unquote, illegally, but they are turning themselves over at the border and they want to be admitted. Right, and we need to welcome those refugees. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're up against, and this is their mode of dealing with catastrophe and collapse and systemic change and the crises of capitalism and climate change, which are one and the same, is violence, paramilitary violence, mm-hmm. and then on the other side of the spectrum, on the right, you've got like the billionaire bunker builders and buying up land near aquifers and building these giant techno complexes
where they're ready.
Kings and all this stuff. So that's mm-hmm. their vision, right? And like, and then they propagate myths around climate change and blame it on the poor and say, you know, the poor are consuming and all the rest. But we have to, I mean, so as I transition back to the Green New Deal, I have to make one factual point clear is that.
Did you say transmission when you meant to say transition?
Transition, yeah.
Oh, how fabulous. Go on.
The wealthy, including, you know, the middle class in the United States, but the uber rich especially, contribute far more to climate change than anybody else. Their consumption patterns, their operation of industry and luxury products and all the rest is far, far more to blame mm-hmm. than poor people that don't consume that much at all. But, you know, for 200 years, rich people have been blaming environmental disaster on poor people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's their side, right? That's what they're moving for. Basically awful future of violence and racism and hell. So
that's the capitalist dystopia.
Right. But so there's declining resources. So let's, you know, narrow the control even more.
And so what's the eco-socialist answer to that capitalist dystopian vision? What?
So the eco-socialist answer is that we disempower the coalitions and people that want that future, and we don't have the power necessarily to do it right now, so we got to build power. And we build power through a vision that rebuilds the working class. And so we mentioned before the New Deal, the past New Deal, is this way that, at least for some sectors of society, there was a new offering of a future, right? Mm-hmm. It was happened to be very heteropatriarchal
and racist. Yes, no doubt.
So there was an internal play there to benefit certain white members of society, white men, over others. And so dispossession economy was operating there too. But still in the kind of like popular conscious, it lingers as like, okay, we got out of the depression, we built it, we had
some social programs.
Right.
That did lift people out of poverty.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the idea is to take that kind of, let's take the positive spin on that, and let's try it again for everybody this time. And
sounds good.
Right. So, you know, we talked before expanding social programs, like providing people with health care and free health care, and starting to reconsider what the housing market is like, right? And what's the value of land? Like, why should we live in cities that are dominated by real estate power? Like, why do they have so much control? What if we started to challenge private property a little bit and talk about public housing that's fully funded and free transportation and expanded public transportation, starting to consider, you know, we usually think about green jobs as in like people building solar panels or, you know, doing sustainable forestry or something like that. But what if we started to think of every job that wasn't directly destroying the planet as a green job? What if teachers were in the green? Well, we considered every teaching job a green job, or every care worker job, or every service job in there as well. And so I think that's...
Shout out to all my home health aides, all my home girls that, you know, it's a carbon neutral job.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, those are the sectors that have been attacked the most through austerity, right? And so, I mean, some of this can be as straightforward as like, let's rebuild a care sector. And people are overworked and underpaid, so we could be adding jobs, splitting the amount of work that's done so people don't have to work themselves, you know, so much. Mm-hmm. So the amount of work that's available is immense, and so we have to fund it. And guess what? There are lots of people that have tons and tons and tons of resources right now that don't need it. Mm-hmm. And then I probably won't get to too much detail, but there's also like a lot of theories about modern monetary theory and governments, you know, being able to basically print and spend money to fund programs like this as well. So if we are able to build the type of power, which isn't just going to happen, we're going to have to do it slowly and surely, campaign by campaign, you know, the put in that sweat equity to make the relationships so that we can build out our coalitions. But if we can do it, then we can start talking about, you know, levers of power and all the rest.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about levers of power. So I just want to, again, thank all of our members, all of our listening community. This is KBOO, KBOO.FM. Please call in and join 877-500-5266 and join the community. Again, that's 877-500-5266, KBOO.FM. Do not change your dial. I just want to bring in the importance of having Nick Caleb on, you know, strident eco-socialist and brilliant movement leader who is giving you the rundown. I mean, the past, present, and future of the fight against Jordan Cove here in Oregon, and laying out a strategy for winning that is doing his due diligence to help to give the people who say that they're our friends, that are elected officials and appointed officials, a chance to do the right thing. You're not going to hear this on a radio station that's being funded by oil and gas giants. This is community radio, and in order for us to stay on the airwaves, we do need your support. And that means joining KBOO. Volunteer your time if you got it. We have people who, as you all know, you've been listening in. I have been doing pitches all week during our spring membership drive, and you can be one of them. 877-500-5266, kboo.fm. And consider getting some of our merch. We have shirts here, KBOO shirts, Democracy Now. What do we have? We have Press Watch, The News You're Not Supposed to Know. A lot of our community partners who we want to bring on as much as possible. Every episode of The Struggle features local people who are doing good work in the community to just give them a boost. To say, okay, I see that you're doing good work. And I know that it is difficult to speak to the media and get a decent hearing because all they want to do is be the devil's advocate. The devil doesn't need an advocate. Okay. The movement needs comrades, people who are ready to do their part to help make the movement more rich and diverse. And that is something that we can offer at KBOO and why you should be a member. Again, that's 877-500-5266, kboo.fm. I'm in the studio with Nicholas Caleb, and we were just talking about some of the dynamics of power here. So, not just Portland DSA, 1,500 members in Portland DSA, nothing to sneeze at. We're going to be going to a convention in August. We get 29 delegates. That's a big deal. But nationally, the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, we're both members, is going to have an opportunity to throw down, to help to swell the power from below. That may be, not maybe, that will be missing from a bill, you know, about the Green New Deal. So if you can talk a little bit about what that power play is going to look like, what is it going to require to really be able to stand up to these giants?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think on the one side, it's the vision, right? And our National Eco-Socialist Working Group put out recently their Green New Deal platform, which is good. Our local chapter endorsed it, and we like it. And so you can find and read through that. Our local chapter, we joined in with the Oregon Just Transition Alliance and 18 other environmental and environmental justice groups to promote kind of like a version 1.0 of a state Green New Deal for Oregon.
Great.
And we'll likely have an assembly in the fall where we'll bring in
September.
Yeah, probably. Okay, and we'll likely bring in folks in a lot of different sectors that we weren't able to connect with the first time through just for time constraints, basically. Okay. But a lot more labor involvement, a lot involvement from houseless and housing advocates and tenants' rights advocates, transit workers, farm workers, pretty much everybody who is, we consider, could be a part of like the Green Jobs Coalition that don't necessarily like think about themselves as environmentalists. And I mean, I work in the environmental movement, but I think the Green New Deal is like, you know, it's got green in it, but it's the important and interesting parts. Yeah, we want to avoid the climate apocalypse, mm-hmm. but I think all of the most inspiring stuff has to do with the coalitions and the solidarity that can be built across sectors of society and putting together a totally different vision for how we want to interact. So that's ongoing in Oregon. I think, you know, as we start that, some of it's we've got existing connections, and there are a couple things coming up that I'd like to just mention where are important kind of like fights as we grow our ranks and we throw down. And so on Sunday, there's actually an oil terminal being constructed in Northwest Portland called Zenith, and Sunday at 1 p.m. there's going to be a rally at 5501 Northwest Front Avenue saying no to oil terminals, right? So much in line with that stop.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. So Sunday, what would that be? The April 21st? April 21st.
Yes, that is 19th. Mm-hmm.
At 1 p.m., 5501 Northwest Front Avenue in the industrial area, Zenith Oil Terminal. There's going to be a rally there in opposition to that project.
Okay.
And, well, and so you might see some of the Extinction Rebellion folks that we talked about before.
Getting involved. I'm ready. Okay. Well, I am very much looking forward to that. Extinction Rebellion. Oh, my goodness. I'm very excited about this. So I want to sign off by saying thank you to Tim from Albany, Oregon. Want to just, you know, give special shout outs to people who hear the call and answer it, right? So Tim from Albany and Autumn from Portland, who helped to match the donation that came in earlier, or the grant that came in earlier from Environmental Paper and Print. So thank you for answering that call. This will really help to boost what it is that we can do here at The Struggle. Nick Caleb, I'm glad that this is going to be going September. I'm ready. I'm in. So let's do this. Thank you, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you. Good night, everybody. Ooh-wee. Okay. Damn. That went really fast. Okay. You can talk. Okay, I have to pull people.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Bridges Cafe and Catering, located at 2716 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Bridges is a restaurant and catering company that's open daily. More information available at bridgescafeandcatering.net. Lunch was provided by Boki Bowl, with two locations at 1028 Southeast Water Avenue and 1200 Northwest 18th at Northrop. Boki Bowl serves ramen with handmade noodles, unique slow simmer dashi, and more. Dinner was provided by Lardo, with two Portland locations at 1212 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard and 1205 Southwest Washington Street, as well as a Las Vegas location at 3708 South Las Vegas Boulevard. Lardo serves deli-style sandwiches as well as craft beers and cocktails every day from 11 a.m. until 10 p.m. or later. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 or go to KBOO.com.